We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. I'm your guest host, Stephen Lyons. I want to remind listeners this is a pre-recorded interview, so we'll not be taking any calls this morning. Today we have the pleasure of having a conversation with Barbara Demick, the author of Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea. I'm especially happy to have Ms. Demick with us today because there's so much going on in North Korea at the moment. The book is published by Spiegel & Grau and is the winner of the 2010 BBC Samuel Johnson Prize. Excerpts of the book have already been published in the New Yorker magazine and the Paris Review. The Philadelphia Inquirer says about the book, Demick takes us inside the minds of her subjects, rendering them as complex, often compelling characters, not the brainwashed parodies we see marching in unison in TV reports. Barbara Demick is currently the LA Times bureau chief in Beijing. She has been interviewing North Koreans about their lives since 2001 when she moved to Seoul for the Los Angeles Times. Her reporting on North Korea won the Overseas Press Club Award for Human Rights Reporting, the Asia Society's Osborne Elliott Award, and the American Academy of Diplomacy's Arthur Ross Award. Before joining the LA Times, Ms. Demick was a foreign correspondent in the Middle East and in Eastern Europe. She lived in Sarajevo during the war in Bosnia and wrote a book about daily life, Lugavina Street, Life and Death in Sarajevo Neighborhood. Her Sarajevo reporting won the George Polk Award, the Robert F. Kennedy Award, and was a finalist for the Pulitzer. As I said earlier, today is a historic day for North Korea, actually this week. A rare gathering of the ruling Workers' Party is meeting right now in Pyongyang. This is the first such meeting since 1980, and speculation is that a successor to the 68-year-old Kim Jong-il will be named. The newspapers have reported that the youngest son of Kim Jong-il, Kim Jong-un, has been appointed general, the clearest sign that he is the chosen heir. He's said to be in his late 20s and was partly educated in Switzerland. Not much else is known about him. The recent news is a rare glimpse of a country most of the world knows little about. When we hear of North Korea, it usually involves hostages, such as reporters Laura Ling and Yunit Lee, who were finally released last year from prison after intervention from former President Clinton. And this summer, Mr. Gomes, who former President Carter escorted out of the country. Returning to the U.S., President Carter recently wrote an op-ed in the New York Times in which, sensing some positive message from that country, urged renewed relations with North Korea, writing, quote, "A settlement on the Korean Peninsula is crucial to peace and stability in Asia and is long overdue." As a way of introducing our guest and setting the scene, here's a small excerpt from the book Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea. The clutter that you see in South Korea is entirely absent. There's almost no signage, few motor vehicles. Private ownership of cars is largely legal, not that anyone can afford them. You seldom even see tractors, only scraggly oxen dragging plows. The houses are simple, utilitarian, and monochromatic. There's little that predates the Korean War. Most of the housing stock was built in the 1960s and 1970s from cement block and limestone, doled out to people based on their job and rank. In the cities, there are pigeon coops, one-room units in low-rise apartment buildings, while in the countryside, people typically live in single-story buildings called harmonicas, rows of one-room houses stuck together like the little boxes that make up the chambers of a harmonica. Occasionally, door frames and window sashes are painted a startling turquoise, but mostly everything is whitewashed or gray. Barbara Demick, welcome to Focus 580.
Thank you very much.
I'm excited to have you here this week. We've been following your reporting on the unfolding events in North Korea, and I imagine you're reporting quite a bit on this story. I know that you've been at the State Department this week. Before we get to your book, what is happening right now in North Korea? What does it mean for the people of North Korea, for the region, and for us? Actually, three questions, but...
Okay, all right. I'll try to answer in order. What is happening is Kim Jong-il, who has led North Korea since 1994, since the death of his father, Kim Il-sung, is trying to extend the family's dynastic rule into a third generation. they had, as you mentioned, a very rare meeting of the Workers' Party conference, the first time since 1980, which incidentally was when Kim Jong-il was put on the route to succession. And they named Kim Jong-il's youngest son, Kim Jong-un, I hope you're following all these names, mm-hmm. to several key posts that will put him in line to be the successor. The North Koreans are very funny. People always say they're unpredictable and weird. Well, they are weird, but they're very predictable. They're following a template from 1980 when Kim Jong-il was, as I said, sent on the road to succession. Kim Jong-un was named to the Central Committee, which in the communist system is kind of like a large board of directors. I mean, it's a big board, about 100 people. He was named as vice chairman of something called the Military Committee, which is within the party. On the eve of the conference, he was named as a four-star general, pretty good for somebody 27 years old, which, you know, gives him the military command. So it is very clear that Kim Jong-il has anointed this youngest son as the successor. Now, the question is, can he actually be the successor? You know, I am still writing heir apparent or chosen successor because I think it's not clear until Kim Jong-il dies. Kim Jong-il is 68. He's had, which is not very old nowadays. His father lived until his 80s, but he's had a stroke. He may have cancer. He may have diabetes. So very possibly he doesn't have very much time. So they've put this whole process of naming the successor into fast forward. Until Monday, this guy, Kim Jong-un's name, had never appeared in the North Korean press. People didn't even know how to spell his name. We still haven't seen a confirmed picture of him. Even by North Korean standards, this is strange. And this is something else that I'd like to mention. You know, we as Americans think, you know, well, this is a totalitarian regime. They can do whatever they want. There's no rules. But even within this very close system, there are rules. And, you know, for example, I live in China, which is certainly not a democracy, but there are people who are very serious about, you know, inter-party rules and how the Communist Party chooses its leadership, and they call it inter-party democracy. Now, we may not consider that democracy, and the North Koreans make no noises about democracy, but even within North Korea, you're expected to prove yourself in the ruling Workers' Party. So for this guy to come from nowhere is weird, and it's really not at all clear, I think, how he will be accepted by the people who maybe don't have very much power and the other members of the elite, particularly the military. I mean, how would you feel if you were a 60-year-old general or even a 40-year-old general and this 27-year-old was promoted to four-star general overnight?
I want to interrupt you just for a second and before I forget this question because you're right on a topic that I think lends itself to this question. You wrote in Los Angeles Times, that youth is not considered an asset in this nation. And you said it isn't easy to sell the public on a 20-something-year-old who's never held a real job. But then considering that the public really has no voice in anything, I was confused by that. Why do they care what the public thinks, the ruling party?
I think the public always has a voice, even though they don't, you know, I don't see a popular revolution in North Korea. I don't see anything starting from the streets. If a faction of the military, of the party, does not accept this, who are the people going to follow? And ultimately, the people, you know, are sort of voting with their feet. A lot of people have defected from North Korea, and a lot of people have chosen not to rebel, but not to listen to what the party tells them. There's been a lot of simmering would I call it unrest? I would say disobedience, not civil disobedience, just disobedience, where people are no longer following these strict communist precepts where they're, you know, going out and trying to earn their money and going out and trying to get their own food and not really listening to the rules. In my book, I focus a lot on an older woman who I call Mrs. Song, who was a very loyal follower of Kim Il-sung, who loved this regime and always did what the party told her. But at one point she said, you know, if I listened to what the party told me, I'd be dead. I'd die of starvation. So, you know, at some point you stop listening.
Mm-hmm. And you certainly chose a city that is as much of a, I wouldn't say breakaway region, but it certainly has had its challenges to the central government.
That's right. My book is set in the city of Chungjin, which is the second or third largest city in North Korea, depending how you count. And this is, I think, a very typical place in North Korea. It's not on the border, but it's relatively close to China. It's on the train lines to China. And the party has been trying to impose its will in Chungjin since the early 90s, and people, as best they can, are trying to resist. As I said, they're not trying to overthrow the government, but they're trying to live their own lives, to earn money privately by growing vegetables or collecting firewood or herbs in the mountains, by making things to sell at the market. And the attitude there is, why doesn't the government just go away and let us live? That is the basic in North Korea. These people do not have the conditions for normal life. They don't have the conditions to eat. I'm not even talking about meat, but rice or even regular corn. North Korea is so poor right now that the average salary is a dollar or two a month. And you know, you're lucky if you can have two meals a day. I wrote about this in my book, happening in the 1990s, and it's happening again now. People can't afford corn. They take an ear of corn and they put the cob and the husk and the leaves through the grinder to extend it further. They're picking leaves and weeds for their basic diet. They're in really terrible condition, and in these circumstances, people don't listen mm-hmm. as much to the government. I have talked to real-life North Koreans about this succession. Starting about a year ago, the ruling Workers' Party began introducing the concept of this young man in these mandatory ideological sessions that North Koreans have to attend. And, you know, they said, you know, we need a leader for the 21st century, somebody who's young and full of spirit and will have bright new ideas. And they've been, you know, gradually, you know, bringing him in without even mentioning his name, because everything is done with a lot of mystery in North Korea. And the North Koreans I spoke to, some of them said, well, gosh, it's great to have somebody young and full of new ideas, and he can bring us advanced technology and bring us into the 21st century. And others, and sometimes the same people said, but on the other hand, given the way his father runs the country and how terrible things are, you know, what can we expect from him? So I ought to wrap this up, but you know, I am not assuming that he is the successor, only that he's the designated successor.
Okay. We're speaking with Barbara Demick, the author of Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea. In this book, you follow six defectors as they flee North Korea through China into eventually South Korea. The book describes them as a couple of teenage lovers courting in secret, an idealistic woman doctor, a homeless boy, a model factory worker, who loves Kim Il-sung more than her own family, and that's Mrs. Song that you mentioned before, and her rebellious daughter. How did you come to meet these six people?
I met these six people at the time I was living in South Korea. They're all living in the South. And I picked them in part because I was doing, I was writing about the city of Chungjin. I decided to pick one city as a microcosm. And in part because I thought that these six people represented, quote-unquote, ordinary North Koreans. All of them started their lives loving the North Korean regime, loving Kim Il-sung, and all of them at some point became disenchanted. And I followed their progression from loyal, unquestioning citizens to awareness. And as I said, I think they represented North Koreans as a whole. I continue to interview North Koreans at the Chinese border. And, you know, I will say these people are not all defectors. Many of them are actually party members and were quite loyal and have come out just to work in an attempt to feed themselves and feed their family. So I don't consider themselves dropouts from society, but I think I have a good grasp of what the attitudes are of North Koreans, and they're scared.
I want to remind listeners that we're not taking calls today. This is a pre-recorded interview. I'm interested in the tipping points for these people. And I know Mrs. Song was sort of tricked into leaving the country. But because there's no internet, there's no news from the outside, there's a huge propaganda and brainwashing machine at work, Mrs. Song seems like such a loyalist. But some of the others were also loyalists, but what tipped them over? Let's start with the doctor, the woman doctor. I thought her story was fascinating. She was right in the middle of the famine, of course, and they all were, but she was witnessing it.
That's right. One of the people in my book, Dr. Kim, was a very idealistic young woman doctor, the daughter of a workers' party, completely loyal. Her family loved Kim Il-sung. She loved Kim Il-sung, and she imagined herself joining the Workers' Party. There were some things that went wrong in her family, but basically she was working in a hospital in the pediatric unit, watching, you know, day after day, 3, 4, 5, 6-year-old children coming in who were dying of starvation with their panicked mothers saying, I don't understand why my child won't stop crying. You know, don't you have any medicine to help? Numbingly watching these dying children. And she managed to, despite all, keep her belief in the regime until she herself was starving. She left North Korea in 1998 and really came out hoping to find relatives in China who might give her some money or food to keep herself alive. And she, like most other North Korean defectors, crossed the Tumen River, which is one of the bordering rivers into China, came out of this river freezing, dripping wet, and walked into the courtyard of a farmhouse in China. And she saw on the pavement a bowl with cold rice and a few scraps of gristle. And she couldn't figure out why this food was on the ground. And then a moment later, she realized it was for the dog. And she told me in that moment, she was maybe 1 hour outside of North Korea, she realized that dogs in China ate better than doctors in North Korea. And furthermore, that everything she had been told her entire life was a lie. And at that moment, again, 1 hour after she crossed the river, she realized she could never go back to North Korea. Everybody I interview has some kind of epiphany. Sometimes it's something that happens when they're still in North Korea. One person told me he saw a nail clipper when he was at the DMZ and realized, oh my God, you know, if the outside world can make such a beautiful instrument out of stainless steel that clips your nails so beautifully, then we are way behind. We're light years behind. It's all a lie. because the underlying myth of North Korea, which is the title of my book, is We Have Nothing to Envy. We have nothing to envy in the world. This name comes from a song that children sing from preschool on. But as soon as they get any kind of glimpse of the outside world, they realize it's all a lie. And I think this is the essence of North Korea's problems. They cannot open up. They can't globalize, because as soon as their people see the outside world, it's all over.
We're speaking with Barbara Demick, the author of Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea. Dr. Kim is also fascinating because she is a doctor. And yet the famine almost taught her to look away, to appear to be insensitive to the starvation around her. But she wasn't at all, because years later you report that when she was asked if she remembered any of the children who died on her watch, she answered sharply, "I remember all of them." And I thought that was fascinating, just fascinating. And the adjustment to South Korea must be so difficult as well.
That's right. That's right. These people come to South Korea and they really lack the skills and the education to fit into society. Dr. Kim, when she got to South Korea, found that her medical training was not recognized at all, and she was very depressed. She was quite honest about this. She really regretted leaving North Korea, and at one point confessed that she had been suicidal. But she's a brilliant woman, and she's pulled herself together. She went through medical school again at the age of about 40, and I think, you know, really applied some of the things she learned in North Korea about herbal medicine and natural treatments, because she's a very talented doctor, and she's now working in South Korea. So she is, you know, I consider a great success story and, you know, a heroine in my mind. But not everybody has done that well. They're not only not prepared for life in South Korea, they're very isolated. They miss their families. Nobody wants to be a refugee. They, I think, realize that they have very little chance of seeing their families again unless North Korea collapses. And I think they have a tremendous guilt about the people they've left behind.
Are the numbers increasing to people leaving North Korea?
I was just told that they are increasing, but it's very, very difficult for them to get out, and it's much harder. In the late 1990s, people could just walk across the river into China and try to work there, but the Chinese eventually became concerned about the stability of North Korea and the large refugee population, and they've been rounding these people up with bounty hunters and sending them back to North Korea. So I think many North Koreans, if not most, are aware that conditions are better in China, but they're afraid to leave for fear that it will only make their situation worse.
The famine of the 1990s is at the center of your narrative. Estimates run as high as 1 million deaths. As you said before, people were eating grass and bark. You said in an interview that the North Korean government did not intentionally starve its citizens. So why did it get so bad?
I don't think they wanted their citizens to starve, but I don't think they were willing to take the measures to allow people to live, because those measures would have made the regime weaker. This is what they always say about North Korea. The regime's primary interest is keeping itself in power, and what happens to the people is incidental. They took a series of very cynical economic moves last year, one in particular, where they discontinued all the currency and issued new as a way of getting money from people who were working at the market. And it hit, you know, just the smallest business people. Like, I can't even call them business people, people who were growing things in the mountains to sell. I met a woman whose family was living by buying bottles of cooking oil from China, dividing them into little bags of a few hundred grams of oil because nobody could afford to buy a whole bottle, selling them, people who were working as porters at the market. all those people who had cash, I would say, you know, an incipient middle class, but, you know, barely just surviving. Those people lost all their money. The markets had to close, and the food situation has gone back to conditions near the 90s. This was done very cynically to make the regime stronger, to prevent a free economy that would have undermined a socialist system where the government controls everything, controls your job and your housing and your education. And no, I don't think they want the people to starve, but I don't think they care enough to stop it.
One person that did not starve was Kim Jong-il.
That's right. Kim Jong-il is maybe the most famous foodie in Asia. He has been notorious for years for importing chefs from Europe and Japan, for sending couriers abroad to buy, you know, the freshest cuts of fish for his sushi, to buy lobsters and wines and cheeses and caviar, and he was a famous consumer of cognac. He's cut that down a bit, and, you know, as anybody who's seen his pictures can see, lost a lot of weight because he's sick. But it really defies imagination that anybody can spend this kind of money on their own diet when his own people can't eat rice.
You write beautifully about the darkness in North Korea, and I'm talking about the light darkness, not the regime. The night sky in North Korea, you write, might be the most brilliant in Northeast Asia, the only airspace spared the coal dust, Gobi Desert sand, and carbon monoxide choking the rest of the continent. You even include a satellite photo. Can you describe the photo to our listeners?
That's right. This is one of the most famous photos of North Korea, or of not North Korea. It shows Asia, Northeast Asia at night, and you can see these pinpoints of light from South Korea, from Seoul. Brilliant, brilliant. You can see the headlights and the streetlights and the shopping malls, and increasingly you can see a lot of lights in China along the Chinese border with North Korea, Dandong, and even some of the cities going up. Lights, cars, construction, the 21st century, and North Korea is just a blank. It's a black hole because there's no light at night. Maybe a pinprick or two in Pyongyang, the capital. And this photo, to many of us, has always symbolized North Korea, because not only is it dark, but we know so little about North Korea, and we tend to see it as a blank. The images that we get out of North Korea, the photographs that accompanied the news coverage about the promotion of the sun yesterday, you know, showed these North Koreans in fancy dress singing and dancing, and their faces blanks. I sometimes say that I think the worst stereotypes that Americans use about Asians, inscrutable Asians, are what we apply to the North Koreans. They're robots. They don't have feelings. And this is nonsense. They're real wonderful people who live in this country. I've met a lot of North Koreans. I've met North Koreans inside North Korea, and they're very warm, very emotional. You know, they're lovely people, and one of the reasons I wrote this book was so that Americans especially would appreciate the humanity inside this country.
And it is a wonderful portrayal of humanity, and I think that's what makes it such a valuable book. The book is Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea. We're speaking with Barbara Demick, and I want to remind listeners we're not taking phone calls. This is a pre-recorded interview. Continuing with this, the darkness, you also write, such darkness is a curse, of course, but it also has its advantages. If you are a teenager dating somebody you can't be seen with, invisibility confers measures of privacy and freedom that are hard to come by in North Korea. You can do what you like without worrying about the eyes of parents, neighbors, or the secret police. Also at the heart of your book is a heartbreaking love story between two people. Who are they?
They are two ordinary people, but not exactly ordinary. They live in a village near the city of Chongjin. The boy is a very talented student. who's headed to university in Pyongyang, who has a brilliant career potentially in front of him, who's potentially going to join the Workers' Party. His family is very loyal to the regime, and they're kind of, you know, among the more upper class of North Korea. His love is the daughter of a miner who has a family secret. Her father was actually born in South Korea, fought in the Korean War on the South Korean side, and as a very, very young man, had been taken prisoner of war and remained in North Korea. And she grew up as a North Korean, but because of this stain, she has tainted blood. And this young couple dates for many years secretly, chastely. It was a very pure young love. And gosh, how much should I spoil the plot?
You don't have to, but at one point she...
There's no happy ending here.
No, there's no happy ending. But Miran, is that how you say her name?
Yeah.
Miran? She takes an incredible risk to see her beau at one point. Maybe you could just give a short synopsis of that story, because I thought this was just an incredibly courageous move and totally guarded or totally motivated by her heart.
Yeah, okay. And this really speaks to all those young lovers or old lovers out there who communicate on Facebook and Twitter and text messages. This romance is taking place in the 1990s, and it might as well be the 1890s. These people have no telephones, no email. They can't even mail a proper letter. Miran has there's no paper. And if you mail a letter, chances are that the people who are delivering the letter are going to burn it because they're so cold. So she's living back in the village near Chungjin. Her boyfriend is in school in Pyongyang, and they communicate again by letter every few months. This is a real Victorian romance. And, you know, you cannot travel in North Korea without a permit. You can't even go visit your sister in the next village, in theory, without permission, or the next town anyway. And she at one point gets on a school excursion to go to a city on the other side of Pyongyang and sneaks off the train, making up a story, sneaks out of the train station without a travel permit. This is extremely risky. I wouldn't say she'd be executed for it, but she could easily be sent to a labor camp and lose her chances of holding a decent job to surprise him at his university. And, you know, I don't want to get people's expectations up. This is a very traditional love story. It's chaste, and it's very pure. But, you know, when I say these people are amazing, she is an amazing person who had enormous courage. And some other things happen later in the book, and that lead to, well, the ultimate denouement of this romance. But
yeah, we don't want to spoil it.
Yeah, she was very brave.
Yes, she was. And,
you know, I will say that these, you know, one of the questions I always ask North Koreans when I interview them is, this is a strange question, but, you know, what's your happiest memory from North Korea? And she has, you know, wonderful memories of the pureness of this romance. And I think this is part of it. People who write about North Korea always write about the deaths and the famine and the torture. And I didn't want to write about the deaths. I wanted to write about the lives. Mm-hmm. And this is a part of life, people who fall in love.
There's also a boy in your book that you report on. He's a petty thief. His name is Kim Hwak. Is that how you say it?
Kim Hyuk. Almost rhymes with Huck Finn, which I told him, which I think is kind of funny.
Yeah, it sort of fits. He ended up in prison for the first time at the age of 16. And why was he arrested?
He was starving. And he was homeless. His parents both died. His father was also a Workers' Party member, a loyalist, who died during the famine. And his father always told him it's better to die of hunger than to steal. But Kim Hyuk did not believe that. and he was one of the first of the North Koreans, just a child, who began swimming across the Tumen River into China in order to get food and to trade. And he, as a very young man, was arrested in that for illegal border crossing, and very nearly was killed in labor camp as a very young teenager. He was 16 at the time, but you know, probably looked more like 12. Even today, as he's in his 20s, he's only maybe 5'1", because he suffered so much from famine during his formative years.
And you have a term for these homeless children?
Yeah, they're called kochibi, which in Korean means wandering swallows. And in North Korea, traditionally, as I said, you couldn't leave home without permission. But during the famine, as families died of starvation, the children would be the only ones left. And they began wandering. They began riding the rails, riding on the tops of trains, trying to find or steal or beg food, and also swimming across the river into China. And there's probably most of these wandering swallows died, but there are a few who made it out. And there are still kochibi in North Korea. Even the last time I was in Pyongyang, which was about 2 years ago, I was on an official tour on a bus, and I saw a homeless boy without shoes, and in Nampo, outside of Pyongyang. But you know, anywhere else, this would not be surprising. You would certainly see this many places in the world. But North Korea is so controlled, to see homeless children is really something.
Now that the book is out, can you return to North Korea?
I hope so. It's never been easy for American journalists to go to North Korea, and I think that's unfortunate. They hold it against us, our nationality as Americans, but I think many of us, although critical of the regime, have written with compassion about the people. And I think what's important for North Koreans, and I say, you know, the regime and the people, is to show themselves as human.
So you would welcome a chance to go back?
Yes, I would.
Okay. Last week I interviewed Patrick Smith, who has written a book about the great shift of economic power from west to the east. It's not particularly an original concept anymore, but what is North Korea's place in this historical shift, if any? How does it see itself?
Well, as I said, it's the black hole, and I mean, this is, you know, kind of the tragedy when you look at the satellite photo. North Korea lives in the middle of the greatest economic miracle of the last few decades. South Korea, its rival, the 12th or 13th largest economy in the world, China up and coming, the northeastern China, where people a generation ago were dying of starvation, now on its way up, people driving, people eating. The North Koreans who come out to China say, oh my God, they eat rice every day, 3 meals a day. This is a luxury. So that I think, is the tragedy of North Korea, that they've been left out.
You know, we still have Americans who hold communism up as an ideal of sorts, an ideal government, a government of fairness. Or at least that's the ideal in their mind. What would you say to them?
Well, North Korea is not the same kind of communist regime as some others, but I don't think this is a question of just of communism. It's a question of totalitarianism and fascism and a country that believes the people belong to the regime and not that the regime belongs to the people. And I think it's unfortunate, for some years the human rights situation in North Korea was seen as only a right-wing issue because it was a communist regime, and I would like to see it, as I think it is, today, much more nonpartisan.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the label axis or being included in the axis of evils served North Korea well at all?
Well, did it serve North Korea well? I don't think it served us well, mm-hmm. us as Americans.
You know, as I read your book, I thought of Emma Larkin's courageous reporting from Burma and Janine DiGiovanni's haunting book about Kosovo, Madness Visible. I have increasingly looked to women journalists to give me a side of war and oppression that, frankly, I think my gender often overlooks. We seem to concentrate more on the battle itself. There's a lack of machismo in the reporting and more of a deep reportage of the human side to all of this. Am I just stereotyping, or am I on to something here?
You know, you're stereotyping, but you're also on to something, yes and yes.
Okay.
I think... maybe it's easier for women to gain the confidence of refugees. You know, maybe women are better listeners, although, you know, I mean, men have also written very movingly about human rights. You know, I think of, the great book about Rwanda written by Philip Gurevich, you know, we're here to inform you that you will be killed with your family. It's, you know, my book didn't really require much courage. It just required listening. It required a lot of patience. I mean, I listened to these people for days and days and weeks and, you know, went over the notes and was very compulsive about, you know, checking my facts and what they said. But I think it's just a matter of listening to the people. And over time, I think North Korea scholars have tended to ignore the North Korean people because they felt they had no voice in the future of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope I can disagree with that.
Mrs. Song's daughter, Oki,
yes.
is her daughter, and
yeah.
she's one of the people that you profiled. She was so different from her mother. How did she end up so dissatisfied?
You know, I almost think genetically she was just a discontent from birth. And I've always marveled at how different the two of them are. Just to go back over the story, Mrs. Song is my very loyal factory worker. Her daughter, her oldest daughter, was very bright, and this, you know, Mrs. Song described her as this, you know, very precocious young thing who memorized all the sayings of Kim Il-sung, and oh, she was so cute when she did that, very quickly became somebody just by nature. She just didn't like marching in step. She wasn't a joiner. She didn't like being a member of the youth party, wearing the uniforms, chanting, and throughout her young life and her married life, she was just somebody who by nature questioned authority, and it wasn't surprising that she very quickly got in trouble with the law, began, sneaking out into China, trying to make a better life for herself. Interestingly, this family, Mrs. Song, who was a much more content, easygoing person and more of a joiner, has been much happier in South Korea than her daughter, who was the one who wanted to leave to begin with.
With technology so ubiquitous, can this kind of repression, this kind of system continue? I mean, it just seems that sooner or later, things have to come in, and they are coming in a little bit, I imagine.
That's right. North Korea is in its own struggle with globalization, just like the rest of us. The North Koreans are increasingly getting glimpses of the outside world. It's illegal in North Korea to watch foreign television or listen to foreign radio. In fact, the televisions and radios are fixed to the government frequencies. But people sneak in, you know, all sorts of stuff, namely DVDs, which are pirated in China, are very, very cheap. DVD players made in China are very cheap, and people will get in movies, soap operas, and you know, this material is not necessarily political, but a North Korean watches a South Korean soap opera and they see in the backdrop the South Korean kitchen with the microwave and the refrigerator full of food, and somebody on their cell phone. South Korea is one of the most wired countries in the world. And they think, oh my God, you know, we thought the South Koreans were starving and pathetic and poorer than us. So any of these glimpses are devastating, devastating to this myth of we have nothing to envy.
I was surprised to learn there's a robust black market in North Korea. I think you just touched on it a little bit, much of it run by the military. Amphetamines is one of the products that's sold by the military?
Yeah, they make amphetamines, especially in the city of Hamhung, which is south of Chongjin. You know, I gather it's all chemical ingredients. Hamhung, ironically, was a great pharmaceutical and chemical center when industry was thriving. It's called Orum or ICE, and many, many people use it. The young woman I interviewed earlier this year, a teenager, told me that a lot of her friends and their parents use amphetamines in part because it cuts the hunger and makes them feel better, but they also sell it in China. And, you know, oddly, as the North Korean regime has cut their people's ability to sell more wholesome products. You know, it's illegal in North Korea to sell, or has been most of the last few years, to sell rice or flour or soybeans or potatoes, and they have all these, you know, weird restrictions. People end up selling drugs.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Barbara Demick, Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea. One last question. We just have time for a short answer on this, and it's probably not fair to you, but what do we need to know about North Korea?
Well, this is my message, mm-hmm. that the people are human, not just like us, but with the same concerns about feeding, sheltering, clothing their children, educating their children. I think people should pay more attention to the everyday situation in North Korea. A lot of human rights reporting focuses on the gulags and torture, and, you know, all of these things are happening, but just the everyday is so horrific that these people cannot eat and they cannot move around to find food. And, you know, I hope to bring more awareness to this situation. A lot of people have been saying to me since they read my book, like, oh my God, North Korea, we had no idea. But honestly, I'm not just being self-deprecating. Nothing in this book is really new. There are no scoopettes. It's all been there, but I don't think anybody's put it together where, again, they see the humanity of these people and understand that this is not something out of the 1960s. It's something that's happening now in 2010.
We have just had a conversation with Barbara Demick, who's the author of Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea. Thank you so much for being with us, Barbara.
Okay, thanks very much.